From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The big guns of the Federal Reserve Bank are meeting today and tomorrow in Washington. Americans want jobs. The Fed seems ready to take action again to inject new money into markets to bring down rock-bottom interest rates even more. But does the Fed still have the power to turn things around? Should it try? And what about the timing? Right before the election, this hour on Point, should the Fed try to juice the U.S. economy now? You can join the conversation. Is the Fed all we've got? Should it dive in again? Is it the right tool? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Economists Alan Blinder and Martin Eichenbaum join me in a moment. With me now from New York is Ben White, reporter for Politico and author of the Morning Money column, which covers the intersection of finance and public policy. Ben White, welcome back to On Point. What is the Fed weighing in these 2 days?
The Fed is weighing just how soft the economy is right now and what, if anything, it can and should do to improve the economy, and particularly the jobless situation. And I think what is probably dominating discussion is the employment report that just came out for August, which showed only 96,000 jobs created. The unemployment rate did go from 8.3 to 8.1, but as you well know, it went down for the wrong reason, which is people leaving the labor force. So we've got a very weak employment picture, and that's part of the dual mandate at the Fed, is to support employment. So what they're talking about is, should they start a new round of so-called quantitative easing or asset purchases, treasuries, mortgage securities, anything that they can do to pump money into the system, keep interest rates low, and push people towards riskier assets as opposed to the safer assets. So that's what they're weighing right now, and certainly the markets and a lot of Democrats expect that they are going to announce a new round of quantitative easing that would take place a little bit later this fall. So we'll hear about that from them tomorrow. But all expectations are they will take new steps to help boost the economy.
Ben Bernanke in Jackson Hole, 10 days ago or so now, expressing grave concern about jobs numbers in this country. That is unusual language for a Fed chairman. If they do it, what exactly would this be? QE3 would have a couple of, or whatever they may announce, may have a couple of parts to it. Like what, Ben?
The biggest aspect of it would be just buying a lot of assets. It would be printing a lot of new money at the Fed. We're talking, in the trillions, to buy basically mortgage bonds, securities that would help to keep interest rates on everything from auto loans, home loans, credit card loans low. They're already fairly low. The idea is to keep them low so people want to buy houses, want to buy cars, want to spend money, and keep them low for a long period of time. The other piece of what they could do is extend the language of when they intend to keep rates exceptionally low for a long period of time into 2014. So they could extend the period of time they intend to keep their benchmark interest rate low, and they could start buying a whole lot more assets to try to keep rates across the yield curve down and encourage people to spend money. The big problem with all of this is the problem right now is a little less that rates are too high. They're not. They're very low. It's that people are having trouble qualifying for things like home loans. Banks' lending standards are very tight right now following the foreclosure crisis and the mortgage crisis. So even people with good credit scores are having trouble getting home loans. So it's not so much an availability there of credit, it's the ability to qualify for it. So that's the question that gets raised, is this really going to make a whole lot of difference to the economy if the Fed does this?
Democrats have won a little more juice in the economy from the Fed for a while now. Republicans saying, no, don't do this, and don't do it on the eve of the election. Here was Ben Bernanke. This was in July before the Senate Banking Committee. You can hear him sort of gearing up maybe for something here. Ben Bernanke.
Reflecting its concerns about the slow pace of progress in reducing unemployment and the downside risk to the economic outlook, the committee made clear at its June meeting that it is prepared to take further action as appropriate to promote a stronger economic recovery and sustained improvement in labor market conditions in a context of price stability.
That's the sober sound of a Fed chairman revving his engines a little bit. We may hear the result or the outcome tomorrow. Republicans pushing back. Mitt Romney, in an interview with Fox Business, this was August 23rd, said that quantitative easing, QE2, QE3, another round of these big asset purchases, he said, doesn't work, not time for it.
I don't think QE2 was terribly effective. I think a QE3 and other Fed stimulus is not going to help this economy. I think that's the wrong way to go. I think it also seeds the kind of potential for inflation down the road that would be harmful to the value of the dollar and I think harmful to the stability that our nation needs.
Ben White, that's maybe the least fierce comment from the Republican side about this. There's been a lot of pushback, including Republicans in Congress saying, you do this and we're going to take you apart, Fed. We are going to dismantle the Fed.
Yeah, the Fed's under a lot of political pressure right now from Republicans. There's been a push for quite a while, you know, led by Ron Paul and others to audit the Fed, to limit the Fed's powers, to do a number of things, to limit its independence, which it's intended to have in its constitution. And for Mitt Romney, you know, part of that is policy. I'm sure that he is worried about the potential for long-term inflation. There's no sign of inflation now, no reason to be worried about that. And, you know, a strong dollar, everybody talks about a strong dollar, but in reality our exports are helped by a weak dollar. I think it's probably more politics than anything else from him, putting a little pressure on, saying you shouldn't be doing this on the eve of an election, with the fear that it could boost the economy a little bit, boost stock markets, and a rising stock market helps an incumbent. So I think it's a mix of probably his true policy beliefs on this and more political pressure on Ben Bernanke to not move in front of the election. But I really do think, you know, when they're finished with their debate, the Fed will move based on the economic information they have before them. They're aware of political pressure. They feel it. They're aware of maintaining the Fed's independence. And I think in order to maintain that independence, they will act based on economic data and not on comments from Romney or anyone else.
The interest rates are already pretty low, Ben. There's some skepticism about whether this big layout of new money will actually work.
Yeah.
But if the skepticism is justified, why are the markets up and why are the Republicans worried? I mean, their fear would be an economic bump before the election that would favor President Obama. Why those two things if they don't think it's going to work anyway?
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it is just how the stock market will react, and the stock market tends to go up if the Fed is buying lower risk assets, if it's buying, you know, mortgage bonds, other things, keeping those rates down, the return on those things down. The alternative for investors is to buy stocks and to buy assets that are perceived as risky. Mm-hmm. So stock markets go up, regardless of whether it'll ultimately have any stimulative economic effect. And that's, I think, part of the fear on Republicans' parts is you get a rising stock market, rising confidence in the economy, and that can be self-fulfilling, even if it doesn't actually, the rate impact is negligible. But, you know, I wouldn't completely discount the, you know, the real economic beliefs that a lot of these Republicans have, that we've done enough stimulating, the Fed's done enough stimulating, it hasn't had a huge amount of impact. We don't want to increase the money supply so much that we start to get inflation. You know, we've been down that road before where the Fed has sort of overshot and created long-term inflation. You know, remember the Nixon days.
Yep.
When the Fed acted and we got runaway inflation that had to be tamed by Volcker and Greenspan. So there is some legitimate concern to having a Fed overreach and create too much money in the money supply and prices go up and we get stagflation. But at this point, there's just no real risk of that. The real risk is that we have persistent you know, unchanging and increasing unemployment and joblessness, and action probably needs to be taken to deal with that and not so much worry about short-term inflation.
Ben White in New York with Political. Please stand by there. Let's get a couple of good economists in here. Alan Blinder joins us right now, professor of economics at Princeton. He was vice chairman of the Board of Governors at the Federal Reserve from 1994 to 96, a member of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors. Alan Blinder, welcome back to On Point, sir.
Good to be here, Tom.
And from Evanston, Illinois, Martin Eichenbaum is here, professor of economics at Northwestern, co-director there of the Center for International Economics and Development. Martin Eichenbaum, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Alan Blinder, you spent some time around the Fed. Put yourself in Ben Bernanke's shoes. If he rolls out new steps tomorrow, what do you expect and why?
Well, I think the why is pretty clear, and it was very clear in your setup piece. The economy's kind of stuck in a rut with very high unemployment. If you look from the point of view of the Fed's mandate, it's got the inflation rate almost exactly where it wants it to be, with no prospect at all of it going up. And it's got an unemployment rate that's just way, way too high by anyone's definition, including the Fed. So that's the why. You do what you can. Now, Ben Bernanke basically focused in his Jackson Hole speech and in other things on two things. And Ben in the setup piece mentioned both of them. One is extending this quasi-pledge to keep interest rates extraordinarily low further back in the calendar,
yep.
say to 2015. And the other is QE3, to buy more assets. And I think the sensible asset to buy, given the legal constraints on the Fed, are probably a mortgage-backed securities, MBS.
And but you hear all the skepticism. I mean, people say it's not going to work. But he's doing it, and it's a lot of money. So the rationale is what? Try, even if it's uncertain if it will work, given how low interest rates are already?
I think that's exactly the rationale. It's less the uncertainty that it will work, although there is some of that, than the magnitude of the effect. Nobody, including Ben Bernanke, thinks that the kinds of policies that are at all feasible are going to have gigantic effects on the U.S. economy. I saw one estimate, for example, just the other day, maybe it was yesterday, suggesting that a QE3 program of the likely magnitude might add 0.25 percentage point to the growth rate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's better than zero, but it's certainly not going to dramatically change the picture.
Martin Eichenbaum, we've just got half a minute here before the break, but if it will give something to growth, why not right now?
Well, I think it would give, based on my estimates and other people like Mark Gertler, who's actually Ben Bernanke's co-author, the magnitude of the effects are very small. And what you have to worry about is the Fed getting the reputation for talking loudly and swinging a very small stick?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about whether the Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank, should jump in now again to juice the U.S. economy, or try anyway, with still lower interest rates, more money in the system, if it's the right time, the right recipe for more push by the Fed. Alan Blinder, economist of Princeton University, joins us this hour. Martin Eichenbaum is with us from Evanston, Illinois, and Northwestern University. Ben White from Politico is here from New York. Just how political can it all get? Well, very political. We all remember this was in Iowa just about a year ago. Texas Governor Rick Perry delivering a sharp critique of Federal Chairman Ben Bernanke's policies and what he might or might not do between then and election time, now right in front of us.
If this guy prints more money between now and the election, I don't know what y'all would do to him in Iowa, but we would treat him pretty ugly down in Texas. I mean, printing more money to play politics at this particular time in American history is almost treasonous, in my opinion.
Almost treason from Texas Governor Rick Perry there, and treating him pretty ugly down in Texas. On Friday, in an interview with CNBC, GOP vice presidential nominee, chairman of the House Budget Committee, Paul Ryan, said a third round of quantitative easing, QE3, would not lead to economic recovery.
All this easing is simply, in my opinion, the Federal Reserve trying to bail out bad fiscal policy. And I think the costs are clearly outweighing the benefits of this.
There's Paul Ryan just last week. Martin, we've got a lot of listeners weighing in on this. And here's Scott. He says, should they act? Yes, absolutely. He says, in the face of congressional gridlock, stalemate, choose your metaphor, and with precious little the president can do on his own to rev up the economy, he says, the Fed is our only hope. That's kind of what Alan Blinder, I'll come to you, Alan, but what do you say to that, Martin?
Well, I think Alan is, first of all, fundamentally right that it is by law one of the Fed's mandates is to be concerned about unemployment. And we can argue or discuss exactly what the right target is, but I think most people think 8% is way too high. But the issue remains, how effective will this action be? So this really does become a quantitative issue. Is this going to work, and is it worth the possible costs? You know, really, we're thinking about a situation where maybe the Fed could reduce long-term interest rates, maybe by 10 to 20 basis points. Does anybody really think that that's a big deal? I think Alan thinks it's a small deal. I think it's a small deal. And the Fed is about to launch on a small deal with probably small consequences. And it will detract attention from the really serious policy issues like the fiscal cliff, which I think Alan and I probably agree with, are far more significant in the short run than the likely consequences of QE3.
So what are the costs? If it gets you something, 10 to 20 basis points, that's that much of a percent in economic growth. I mean, we're hungry for growth right now. You said there's a reputational downside for the Fed if it doesn't work. Well, maybe they can absorb a reputation. Is there a bigger cost than that, Martin?
Well, I think there are consequences of building up the Fed's portfolio of assets that it holds. Remember that the Fed's balance sheet went from $1 billion; it's now going to be well over $3 trillion. And you really do worry about the what might or might not happen when interest rates do rise. Will the Fed lose money on that portfolio? It's true that it can print some more to take care of it. But you well can imagine a situation where the Fed takes large losses and the risks to the institution are very large. Now, do I think that that should overturn whether they should do QE3 or not? I don't think that's a first order for my concern, but I do think it's one of many concerns, small concerns that go along the potential small benefits of QE3. I also think if people aren't clear that this isn't going to solve our problem, you potentially get this overreaction. Oh, my God, the Fed has tried. It didn't help. What happens now?
Alan, how about it? Risks to the institution and its reputation for a small payoff. Is it worth the nickel?
I think it's very much worth the nickel. There is a little bit of risk, as Marty says. I don't worry about it very much. I think a much bigger risk to the Fed's reputation would be either if it was seen as bowing to political pressure, in this case from the Republicans. By the way, historically, it's more often come from Democrats, but now it's coming from Republicans, or fail in its mandate. The Fed has a legal mandate. It didn't make up that mandate. Congress did. And the operational part of the mandate right now is to get the unemployment rate down. So I think that's by far the biggest risk to the Fed's reputation. Now, in a nicer, more orderly world, Congress would be taking action to do this. Congress has more powerful weapons right now at its disposal.
Like
that's
what,
not always
Alan?
True, but I have suggested, and many others have suggested, pairing a big short-term stimulus program with a bigger, much, much bigger long-term deficit reduction program. Mm-hmm. Congress could do this. This is the grand bargain plus.
Right, right.
Congress could do that, but of course Congress is not going to do that, and we all know that.
So that leaves it to the Fed. What about the inflation risk that Mitt Romney raised? We heard him in the tape there.
I think, as you were saying before, it's non-existent in the short term. If the Fed is really foolish and incompetent, you get a substantial risk for the long term. What I mean by that is as the economy starts coming back to life, the Fed has to start exiting from the extraordinary programs that it's put in place during the emergency. Most of that is gone, and now during the tremendous weakness in the economy. Now, this is not that hard. If it gets its balance sheet blown up by buying assets, well, guess what it has to do to shrink the balance sheet? Sell assets.
But
they know that.
But how does this work? I mean, Martin's pointing to the – it'll be more than $3 trillion if they announce and take new steps starting tomorrow.
Right.
That's a lot of money that's been put into the system. If they're promising low interest rates until 2015 – can they keep that – if they come out with that, can they keep that and still be ready to come in if the economy starts coming back to dampen inflation?
Yes, I think so. I think so. If they wind up promising through 2015, the economy starts soaring in 2013-14, they're going to be a little bit embarrassed as they renege on that quasi-commitment that lasted – on the interest rates that lasted till 2015. They'll have a little egg on their face, but I think they'll be happy to have that egg on the face because the economy is doing – better. And it's only when the economy starts doing better that you want to start shrinking the balance sheet. And you don't need to bring it back all at once. You do it very gradually, just as it was it was built up very gradually. There was a sudden burst after Lehman.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, it's been relatively gradual. And it's just not that difficult. A lot of what the Fed holds are treasuries, which have the biggest, deepest, most liquid market in the world. You can go in, and that's why they're in there. You can go in and buy or sell huge volumes of money. The MBS would be slower. It's not as thick and deep a market, and you would wear down your stock of MBS. The Fed would
selling MBS,
at a slower.
What's that?
I'm sorry, mortgage-backed securities. Uh-huh. These are the things that indirectly affect mortgage rates.
What kind of mortgage rates might be produced by another round of Fed intervention here? I mean, they're already near historic lows. How low could they go?
I'm not so different from Marty on this. I think we could probably do a little bit better on the mortgage rates via the MBS than 10 or 20 basis points. I think I have an idea he was probably referring to treasury rates, which are harder to move. But we could probably move them down by another quarter to a half a point with a serious buying program, something like that.
Ben White, is there a sense that that would be enough to move the housing market?
No, there's really not that much of a sense that it would be. As I mentioned before, it's less a question of the interest rates people are paying on their loans as getting the loans in the first place, and the lending standards being tight and banks being tighter with the extension of credit. So would it be helpful? Sure. But I think a lot of, like what we're talking about, the Fed's actions, it would be kind of at the margins with helping people with mortgage loans. It would free up a little bit of cash, though. If people are paying a little bit less, they can refinance into a lower-rate mortgage. Obviously, they have a little bit more money per month to put into the economy. So it would help, I think. Would it help very much? It seems unlikely to me, but that doesn't mean that the Fed shouldn't be trying. And as we've stated, they have this clear legal mandate to combat this 8.1% unemployment rate. So it is hard for me to imagine they don't.
Ben, do you see time here between now and Election Day for Fed action to have some kind of result, economic tweak up that would help President Obama? I mean, you remember President George H.W. Bush famously, bitterly saying Alan Greenspan cost him his second term because he didn't get in there and do something. Could this work to President Obama's benefit before by Election Day, Ben?
Right. Certainly a lot of Democrats say, you know, too little, too late from the Fed. Where were you months ago doing more of this? I mean, they were doing some quantitative easing, but doing more and more rounds of it. I don't think so. In the few 50 days, 55 days we have to Election Day, you're going to see a measurable economic impact. We've got really one more meaningful jobs report between now and then. It's not going to show up in that. I think where it could show up is in the stock market and in the rise in riskier asset prices and the stock market bounce after an announcement tomorrow. And we've seen correlation between a rising stock market and voting patterns. People see the Dow going up. They tend to feel a little bit better about their own finances. Their retirement statements coming in the mail look a little bit better, and they're less sour about the incumbent than the state of the economy. People are still going to be somewhat grumpy about this economy going into Election Day. That's factored into all the models. But I think in terms of the impact of a QE3, it will not be on short-term economic growth. It'll be on the stock market and investor and voter psyche based on the stock market.
Ben White, Alan Blinder, Martin Eichenbaum. Let me go to our listeners. Don is calling from South Windsor, Connecticut. Don, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
One of the things that nobody's discussed, Bernanke and none of them, and I'm very incensed about this as a senior, nobody talks about the effect on savers. Why are we rewarding inconsiderate borrowers at the expense of savers? We're the ones that provided all the money for this economy.
You're talking about American senior citizens who have put money away for years, counting on that to provide an interest income for their retirement, and now it is next to nothing.
That's right. Basically, today, I have money in money market accounts with some of the largest firms in the world, Goldman Sachs, Fidelity, and the rest of them, and they're paying 0.01%. You know what that means? That means on $100,000, you're getting $10 a year.
You can get a sandwich.
You realize there's $3.5 trillion sitting in these accounts with earning next to nothing. If they were paying 5%, there'd be $175 billion flowing into our economy now, and the seniors would spend it all. I'd like to have somebody discuss why we're rewarding the borrowers who are inconsiderate versus the savers who provide the basis for this whole country's economy.
Don, I'm really glad you raised that, and with just that fervor about it. I mean, Alan Blinder, you can hear the righteous anger there, and there are millions like Don, and the ones riding on all that money now and paying out nothing to have it are the banks who, as you suggest, you know, many people see as having screwed up. Here he's saved. He and many others now, you know, it's an empty bone they're getting.
Don is absolutely right. The savers, and it's not so much the savers as people, especially retired people, that are living on interest.
But they saved to put that away, and now it produces nothing for them under this kind of policy.
No, that's absolutely right. And what I was going to say is they are the unfortunate victims of the collateral damage of this total war on a lack of economic activity. Unfortunately, what we need now in the economy is more spending, not more saving. For the long run, of course, we need saving. But in this short run hole that we're in, we need people to spend. We need businesses to spend.
But the interest rates have been so low for so long, and it's not happening. I mean, I've got one listener here, Alan, excuse me, but this is a listener who says, look, what would happen because you've got trillions just parked and going nowhere, not being spent. So what would happen if instead of holding interest rates at near zero, the Fed announced it plans to set a target of 10% annual inflation? Think of that, you know, like an expiration date on money. Use it or lose it. And would that kick it out of the coffers, Alan?
Well, I think that would kick some of it out of the coffers.
It would make Don happy also in Connecticut. He'd be living large again.
Well, I don't know if Don wants 10%. I don't think Don wants 10% inflation, and I know Ben Bernanke doesn't want 10% inflation. That's definitely not I can assure you that that's not in anybody's cards.
But, I mean, Martin Eichenbaum, how do we get money moving here? If these already super low interest rates don't do it, a little lower makes our seniors and savers more unhappy. But will it get the money moving, Martin?
Well, let me just reiterate that I certainly agree with Alan that these low interest rates certainly hurt savers. There's no doubt about that. But it is very important to emphasize that the reason rates are low is only partly because of the Fed. There's not exactly a tsunami of demand for funds out there, right? If you go to big businesses, if you go to small businesses, there's a lot of reason they're not investing. They're uncertain about their tax climate. They're uncertain about demand for their product. And under those circumstances, they're not exactly climbing over each other to get money from seniors,
right?
They just don't want to borrow a lot.
Yeah.
And that's the problem so it's partly the Fed. It's partly the objective situation that we're in. So the Fed can't magically make real interest rates a really, really big number if people don't want to borrow. So we somehow have to kickstart this.
Yeah. Alan, who's going to crank up the demand? I mean, clearly Fed action hasn't done that so far.
Well, the Fed is doing what it can and has been since, going back to 2008, the Fed has been trying to crank up demand. And it's had an effect, for sure. But the hole was very, very deep. And while in 2009 and 2010, the Fed was getting substantial help from the political government, from the Congress and the president with spending and tax cuts, it's getting hindered now. A lot of people don't know this, but the part of the GDP that has behaved most poorly in the recovery it's not housing, actually. It's government purchases of goods and services. That means hiring, or more recently, firing school teachers, firefighters, building fewer roads, the works. The government, the spending part of the government, actually buying things, has been shrinking, and that's making the Fed's job of boosting total spending in the economy that much more difficult.
But that's right where Paul Ryan and others focus. They say we have to get spending under control. We got to pull back here. What that's the timing issue, I guess.
It's exactly the timing, and it's not we don't want to trivialize it by calling it timing. This is not a matter of this month, next month. For a while, the economy is going to be weak, and we need to pre-commit as best you can in a constitutional system to substantial deficit reduction down the line, but not do it now. And in fact, if anything, we should be doing the opposite. This isn't an ideal world, but we all know that that's not going to happen. And in the meantime, what are we worrying about? We're worrying about falling off the fiscal cliff and seeing a huge drop in government spending starting in January. That would be like the worst thing you could imagine.
Martin, I mean, again, in that situation, you'd still – we're better off, you think, if the Fed just sat tight, really?
No, I just want to emphasize that two things. One, whatever the Fed does now, it's peanuts. I mean, that's the bottom line. It's just peanuts.
Now, you'd
say a small peanut in the sense of getting us out of the recession.
Yeah.
In the sense of getting us out of the recession. And it's very important for people not to have false or be misled about what's at stake here. I would say one thing to Alan, because I do agree we need to get the long-term deficit under control. The same kind of models that are at the core of the Fed's decision-making say that uncertainty about how we're going to deal with the deficit have an enormous impact on the economy right now.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're with economist Alan Blinder and economist Martin Eichenbaum today, and Ben White of Politico and Morning Money, looking at the Fed and whether it's time for it to juice the American economy. Again, QE3, they're talking about it right now in Washington, an announcement tomorrow. The markets and more are expecting that Ben Bernanke will say yes, and here's what we're going to do. We've got lots of callers standing by. Jill in Knoxville, Tennessee. Jill, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that whatever the Feds do, at least I feel like they're paying attention. I know the president can't do much and they can go on with their rhetoric and whatnot, But I'm really, really, really seriously disappointed with Congress. They know that we're all standing still watching to see what's going to happen, you know, with this fiscal cliff thing. So I have to hand it to, you know, Bernanke. At least he's trying. I don't feel like there's many other people in Washington who are really paying attention.
Jill, I see you are, and I appreciate your call. And let me get one more right on its back. Springfield, Illinois. David is calling. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom. I'm concerned about the language of the politics of this whole situation, and thinking that doing something positive becomes political. And even I know you're looking for listeners and interest, but even the term juicing the economy to me is a concern that we can't talk about this in terms of what it really means to people, you know, average people in the country.
Well, I mean, it needs some juice, doesn't it? Isn't that the point?
Well, but when we first said that, I'm thinking juice of illegal substances, whether it's in sports,
okay.
Steroids.
Okay.
Does that mean it's illegal?
I wasn't going to steroids, but okay.
Meditation.
Yeah, yeah.
So by juicing it, I just think that the rhetoric is gets out in front of the reality, and like the previous caller just mentioned about the Congress, can't we look at what's really impeding growth, not passing the jobs bill, or looking for ways to get people back to work, that it would take something like the Fed? It's just mind-blowing to me that it would take that much.
David, I appreciate your call, and Jill's as well. And let's look at Congress here. I mean, we've got lots of people riding in. Matt says, people got no jobs. People got no money. The Fed's mandate is full employment. If they're not using every weapon at their disposal, they're failing the American people. Stupid, cowardly to hesitate, he writes. Call Me Missouri says, I applaud Ben Bernanke for his brave and astute actions. I didn't think there was anything the Fed could do, and yet here we are, and they're trying to do something which is more than Congress is doing. Call Me Missouri is not too happy with Congress. Stupid losers, he says. Martin, what about Congress? What could Congress be doing that would make it less, perhaps, important for the Fed to be out there?
I would say the following, that the single most important problem, long-term problem facing the country is the deficit. And I know Alan and I completely agree on that. I think it would be absolutely first order importance if Congress could have a way of committing to entitlement reform and phase that in gradually. I think everyone could agree on that we don't want to have a massive fiscal cliff next year. But we cannot go on the way we are without long-term entitlement reform.
Is that about the economy right now and the employment rate right now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think uncertainty about what will happen to future taxes, what will happen to future spending, how the health industry will be organized is absolutely affecting investment in those industries right now.
Alan, how about it? I mean, you say the same thing, look to the long-term deficit, but you want government action, some government spending, I guess, right now for the short-term pop.
Yes, right now. Marty was hinting around this. This is not the time. Look, we could solve the deficit problem in January by falling off the fiscal cliff and just staying there. That would do it. It would also kill the economy.
Mm.
That's an extreme example of what we don't want to do but are in small bits and pieces doing to ourselves. If you go back to last year, President Obama suggested a jobs program that I thought was pretty good. Not perfect, but pretty good. The CBO estimated it would add 1 to 2 million jobs. Nothing the Fed has left in its arsenal can add 2 million jobs. This would have been much more powerful. If we could have combined that with the so-called grand bargain, which is something like a Simpson-Bowles magnitude deficit reduction over 10 years, that wouldn't have solved all our problems magically, but it would have been a giant step, a giant step. The Fed can take baby steps. Mm-hmm. That's all it can do at this point.
Ben White, come in and help us think here about who's acting and who's not. I mean, here's Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee. This was on CNBC on August 29th, and he's kind of suggesting that the Fed's getting in the way of Congress. Here he is.
What you see is policymakers in Washington really leaning on the Fed to deal with the economic issues that our country has. And what I think it does is take the heat off Congress to do the things that Congress should be doing right now to really stimulate the economy, which is to deal with our fiscal solvency.
Ben White, is Senator Corker just right there, or does he have some of what did President Clinton call it, brass, to put it that way, when Republicans have been for some things but also against a lot of congressional action?
Yeah, I think he's probably showing a lot of brass there. I mean, Congress is not failing to act because of the Fed and thinking it's going to get bailed out by the Fed. I mean, it's a convenient kind of scapegoat there. But, you know, Congress is completely gridlocked on fiscal policy, and there's no short-term prospect that that's going to change. And my fear is that there isn't much of a long-term prospect of it either. And part of the problem is that we had two elections. We had President Obama elected in 2008, and then in 2010, the Tea Party ascended to a great position of political power and helped Republicans take control of the House on a platform of austerity, of cutting spending, of dealing with the long-term debt by slashing government spending. And so Republicans understandably felt fairly beholden to that constituency when in negotiations on this grand bargain, and at one point seemed a little willing to increase some revenues in addition to cutting entitlement spending long-term, but ultimately weren't able to sign off on that deal. So I'm sympathetic to callers and emailers who decry the state of gridlock in Washington and how policymakers can't seem to agree on a long-term plan for deficit and debt reduction or any short-term stimulus now. But you also get the government that you elect. And, we have now had the American people send conflicting signals time after time on what they want their government to do. And now there's this idea that we're going to get a clarifying election in 2012 that will make it clear whether people want, more spending or a lot less spending and big tax cuts. And I just don't think we're going to get that. I think we'll probably get Congress the same way it is now. And, it looks fairly likely that President Obama gets reelected, certainly not a guarantee, but it leaves you in a very similar position in 2013 than we're in right now.
And there comes the fiscal cliff. Alan Blender, I want to ask you about the dissent we have heard within the Fed. Here's a little tape from Dallas Fed President Richard Fisher talking with Bloomberg News on August 8th about why he opposed further quantitative easing, which may, in fact, be announced tomorrow. But here he was.
I believe we have done our job. We have done enough. Just doing more doesn't solve the problem. The problem is engaging the transmission. We've provided the gas. The gas tank is full, as I like to say. Who's going to incent the driver of this economy to step on the accelerator and move it forward? And that's the private sector.
What about Alan Blinder? There's the Dallas Fed president saying, look, we've done our job. It's not our turn. We're done. We've done all we could.
Well, I think that's a very defeatist attitude. I mean, what he said about the private sector being the basic engine is tautologically true. Of course it is, that we're a private economy, basically. The government doesn't decree the growth rate. But the government has a few levers via which it can exert influence up or down on the growth rate. One of them we were just talking about, fiscal policy, budget decisions, and the other one is the Federal Reserve. And when you've got the Congress gridlocked, you know, we're talking about this like it's symmetric. What we really mean is the Republicans in the House are blocking everything.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get any help from that quarter, and that leaves the Fed. So, my attitude is if you're fighting a losing battle and you're down to pickaxes and pea shooters instead of bazookas, well, you use the pea shooters. Richard Fisher's attitude is the opposite.
Martin?
Well, I think it's really important to emphasize that Fisher, President Fisher, mm-hmm. and Alan and I all agree we're talking about pea shooters here. And so then there's a political judgment.
Yeah, but you don't come after the Republican immediate action or lack thereof in the Congress. You're saying long term. I mean, Alan's saying, do something now, Congress. What about that?
Oh, I have no problem with – I mean, Alan and I have talked extensively about mm-hmm. fiscal policy. And as Alan knows, I have no problem whatsoever with expansionary fiscal policy right now. I do think for it to be maximally effective, it has to be coupled with – long-term reform.
Wasn't that the grand bargain idea last summer?
I bet if Alan and I sat in a room, we could have come up with a grand bargain really quickly.
There we go. Who will be Boehner and who will be Obama?
I'll be Obama.
I'll leave Marty to answer that.
Let's get a call from New Orleans. Richard's calling. Hi, Richard. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Do
you think?
I recently read Paul Krugman's book, In This Depression Now. I would assume your guests are familiar with it and with his positions. And, you raised the point a few minutes ago about, what about some inflation, 10%, maybe you were using a little hyperbole there, but that's exactly part of the prescription that the doctor has ordered, according to Krugman. If we had inflation running at 4 or 5%, it would be really good for the economy and for the debt picture. That's one of his minor points. But his major point is like austerity. What? In the middle of a depression, and when we're in the middle of a liquidity trap, it's a politically popular proposition that everybody's bought into, unfortunately, including Obama. And austerity is the last thing you need. You need massive stimulus now. I'll let the panelists take up those points.
Thank you very much, Richard, in New Orleans. Alan Blinder, first, let's go back to inflation for a minute. Paul Krugman's not the only one who said, let's bring on a little. Not just that, and certainly not austerity, he says, but let's have a little inflation. Kenneth Rogoff said the same thing.
There is a solid intellectual argument in that direction. Two big problems with it. One is, how in the world do you get it? Suppose the Federal Reserve Act was amended tomorrow, and the instructions to the Federal Open Market Committee was to bring the inflation rate to 6%. There's nothing they could do that, I don't believe. They would have no idea how to do that in such a weak economy. They're much more worried about inflation falling too low, and they are trying to fight that and try to get to the 2% or stay at the 2%. Inflation target. The other problem is the credibility for the future. So the rest of that program is basically, okay, we promise 4, 5, 6% inflation for a while, but then we're going to go back to 2% inflation. It's a tough sell, I think, to financial markets. And if they saw the Fed actually succeeding in 5 to 6% inflation, which I don't think they would, but if that would happen, I think you would have a big problem with long-run inflation expectations. They would not stay anchored at 2%. And let me just a word on the on fiscal austerity. That's what I've been speaking against. To me, it is borderline crazy to be looking at historically low interest rates, unemployed construction workers, mm-hmm. and huge infrastructure needs, and not be building things now.
We could borrow so cheaply and do it and put people to work. Why aren't we? Martin Eichenbaum, what do you say to that?
Well, I certainly would endorse an increase in government spending if we at the same time came to a bargain on long-term entitlements. I think Alan is right that right now the odds that the fiscal multiplier, the efficacy of an increase in government spending, that would have a positive impact. I agree that would be good. However, unless we simultaneously solve the long-term entitlement problem, this country will be in very, very serious danger. And I don't think anybody who's looked at the budget numbers disagrees with either of those two propositions.
Ben White, it sounds like time for let's make a deal here. I mean, is there a chemistry under all this pressure for GOP, for Democrats to be ready to bargain and actually do it, put the cliff aside, try and get around this, really bring an answer on, spend something now. Yeah. Look at the situation down the road and reach some kind of deal that would get things going.
It all makes such logical sense, and you get smart people like these in a room, and they can come up with a very reasonable package of short-term stimulus and long-term entitlement reform. And to economists, conservative economists, that makes perfect sense, and you don't pursue austerity in the face of a very weak economy teetering on the edge of another recession. But that is so disconnected from the discussion right now that goes on in Washington. There is no constituency still on the Republican side for any more deficit spending, for any more stimulus. I mean, maybe stimulus is less of a...
Why not? Is that just to keep it...
Because their constituency is not for it. I mean, the Tea Party still has power. There's still a lot of concern about anything that would increase the deficit further. And that, Mitt Romney is running on the idea that this was a failed stimulus. Republicans are running on the idea this was a failed stimulus rather than a stimulus that didn't go far enough and should be extended.
So, but Republicans know about growth and that you need growth to get out of holes.
Right, and they want tax cuts to deal with it. They want tax cuts across the board. They want 20% reduction in marginal income tax rates. They want corporate tax reform, all things that probably could get worked out in a long-term negotiation about tax reform and entitlement reform and government spending. But the politics of it, certainly before the election, make any of it impossible. The question is, does the dynamic change in some way after the election? And perhaps it does, but there's a window there where the pressure comes off a little bit under a second Obama administration or a first Romney administration, where both new presidents or a reelected president would want to come up with a big sweeping deal to take all of this stuff off the table and not have their term dominated by it. But I just have a hard time seeing how that's going to play out, how we get to a point where it's less toxic in the political environment.
Alan Blinder, real pain below. Here's Emily writing to us. How about this? You give me a job that pays the bills and leaves me enough left over to have some spending money, and I'll go spend it. She writes, she says, I hate these economists. They have no idea what it's like down here with no jobs that pay enough. I mean, there is real pain and even rage below this whole fancy conversation. Where does that go, Alan? I guess November tells us something about that.
I'm sorry Emily hates economists, but I couldn't agree with her more. That's exactly the objective of this exercise, to get more people who are now not working, working. That's it.
Let me just say one last thing. Yes. Short-term fiscal stimulus comes in two forms, increasing government spending and cutting taxes.
Yeah, it can come both ways.
Maybe you have to cut taxes in the short run and have that long-term grand bargain.
Maybe there's that deficit, too. We'll be watching as the Fed comes out with whatever it rolls out tomorrow and be better informed for this conversation when we see it. Martin Eichenbaum at Northwestern University, professor of economics there. Thanks so much, professor.
Thank you.
Alan Blinder at Princeton. Always great to have you. Thank you for joining us, Alan.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Ben White with Politico. You're the greatest. Thanks, Ben. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.